Good evening and welcome to episode 12 of the Borussia Dortmund Fan Club London podcast, where we talk about everything to do with Borussia Dortmund and the Bundesliga. And wow, episode 12, time flies when you're having fun. And this evening I've got with me Mark Shepherd, which many of you will know from previous shows. Hello, Mark.
Good evening, Ben. How are you doing?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I've been trying to get my head down and do some studying for my master's today. But apart from that, it's been quite hot and sunny, so it's been difficult to concentrate. But yeah, it's great to be doing the show again, and great to have you on the show. Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
What have you been doing today?
Today, I had a tennis lesson this morning, which was very good. I haven't hit any balls for a couple of weeks. I'm a big tennis player, so that was great fun. And then, just been doing a little bit of work this afternoon. So, it's not been too stressful today.
Okay. Excellent. I also play a bit of tennis. And the chairman of Borussia Dortmund, Dr. Raubal, is also a great tennis player. So,
okay.
Yeah, it'd be great to play tennis with you sometime. And,
absolutely.
Of course, as on every week, we have a special guest. And I'm sitting here. You can't see it, unfortunately, but I'm sitting here wearing my signed England shirt from the World Cup 2017 in India, where I was a volunteer at the FIFA World Cup, which was signed by none other than Jadon Sancho, a pretty big England player, and hopefully will be one of the key players at the Qatar World Cup. And on the show tonight, we've also got another very esteemed England player who we'll certainly be hearing quite a lot from him tonight, but he's made an incredible impression on the England side, one of my favourite England sides, and also played an extraordinary campaign with Nottingham Forest that led them all the way to winning the Champions League, what was then the European Cup, and also had a remarkable career in the Bundesliga and is very fondly remembered with FC Cologne. And of course, Mark will be particularly excited to hear this gentleman's career with Arsenal Football Club, where for 3 years in a row, he was the lead scorer. And my goodness me, I've watched some of the videos. I was very young at the time, but this gentleman really was a great footballer and a great striker. So tonight we'll hear the striker's story from none other than Mr. Tony Woodcock. Good evening, Tony Woodcock.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Mark. Ben, you finally got me. You've been chasing me now for a couple of years. You finally got me on your programme, yeah? But the first thing, I was top scorer for 4 years, and I don't class myself as an out-and-out goal scorer, but at Arsenal, it was 4 years on the trot. So I thought, I'm quite proud of that stat, so I thought I'd just throw that one in. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's true, Tony. We've talked about various different games and so on that we were organising. There was the Gordon Banks Memorial Match, and also there was a talk show we wanted to do with your old friend Marcel Raducanu, who we had on before the show. And it was an absolute pleasure to be on the show with two legends like yourself. I wasn't aware of that, but I certainly know that you were lead scorer at FC Cologne as well, because somebody reminded me that this morning.
I didn't realise that until you sent it to me, but high praise indeed, because if you've got people like Pierre Lebowski in the team and Klaus Fischer, Klaus Allofs, Thomas Allofs, everyone's fighting for places and fighting for minutes on the field, and so that was interesting to see, and nice.
Absolutely fantastic. So now we've got acquainted, I'm going to pass over to Mark, who will start with the first part of the show, really just talking about you've both got a Brian Clough story in common, and it doesn't get much bigger than Brian Clough, quite frankly. So over to you, Mark, and the Forest years, I'm sure you're going to enjoy this bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks very much, Ben. I guess, first of all, Tony, really, even just sort of prior to Forest, I'm curious to know what got you interested in football in the first place. How did you start kicking a ball around?
Yeah, it's a strange one, really, Mark. I hadn't got any interest whatsoever until my parents moved house, and the local lads, on the streets, there were always a few years older than myself. And my brother-in-law, he bought me a pair of football socks just out of the blue and said, "Oh, I bought you these football socks." And I know it sounds strange, but I put them on, and that got my interest in football and got me going out on the streets and playing football and getting really into it. So I started about 13 through these football socks, then played for the school, played for the local youth club. And the youth club, it used to get us all off the streets, basically, which was called Priory Celtic. So there was just a group of us there, which is now turned into a very, very good youth club football team, or team, should I say, who have done very, very well over the years. So really, a bit of football shop, playing football on the streets, getting interested to it, playing for the school, playing for a local youth club, and then being picked up by Nottingham Forest.
Wow, fantastic. I've got fond memories myself, and probably you too, Ben, as well, just those sort of early days when I guess there wasn't as much traffic on the roads, and
yes.
You know, we'd play football in the streets, and then you might get one car comes along, and you have to quickly dash onto the pavement, but then, you know, you're back again and playing again. So I can completely appreciate that. It's fantastic. And then, as you say, you know, you started like that, and then, so how did the first sort of contract come about with Nottingham Forest? How did they spot you?
Well, first of all, when I say playing on the streets, we used to play on the local recreation ground where there was a few of the older guys, right? You know, used to kick the hell out of me, to be quite honest with you, right? Because I was getting better and better. And then, obviously, after I started playing for Nottingham Forest, right, their sons would come to me, right, and ask for autographs and said, you used to know my dad. My dad used to kick hell out of you on the football field, and that toughened you up, and that's got you where you are today. So those stories keep going on and on. So I was playing for Priory Celtic, and a scout, Alan Hill, who used to play goalkeeper for Nottingham Forest, and then he was assistant manager under Brian Clough. He came to watch my friend, Marky Smith, who was playing in goal, who had a trial at Arsenal, and he spotted me, and he went over to my mum and dad and said, I'd like to have a chat with you, and would like to get him down for a trial. So I went on, I know, three or four occasions and played trial matches at Nottingham Forest. And then when it came to, I must have been, 16, you know, just about leaving school, 16 and a half, and they offered me an apprentice professional contract, which, you know, means you're an apprentice professional, so you've got a number of chores to do in and around the ground, whether it's cleaning the ground, cleaning the boots, and all that sort of stuff. And then you have to prove yourself that you're going to be good enough to be offered a professional contract. And of course, there must have been about 15 apprentice professionals. And of course, every one of them thought that they were going to make it. And they tell you right in the early days that there's only going to be a couple of you here out of this group that will be offered a professional contract. And so then that's the next stage. And there were actually only two were offered a professional contract out of that group, and that was myself and Viv Anderson. Right, so we started together at Nottingham Forest, right? So, and then once you get your first, you know, offer, and in those days, I was offered, I can't remember exactly what it was, something like, I think it was £13 a week, right? And I said, I'd like a little bit more than that. I would like 18 or £20 a week, because that's what the second year professionals, the ones who had already been professional for 1 year, that's what they were being paid. And they said, well, they're second year professionals. And I said, well, you know, I think I'm better than them, right? And they said, no, we can't give you a second year's professionals contract. So I didn't sign, and they kept me sweating for about 10 days, right? It's my first contractual sort of negotiation, you know, at 17 years of age. And I spoke to my youth trainer, and he said, listen, you're a good player, you know, you should hold out for whatever you think, and if it's not going to be Nottingham Forest, someone else will take you. But it was a stressful situation until they finally came round. They were offering me a fortune on appearance money, offering a fortune on points money, and I said, no, but I need the basic wage, so I'm guaranteed what I'm going to be earning. And they finally gave in, and that stood me in good stead. You know, going for what you think you're worth over the years. When the money was a little bit more than £20 a week. Yeah? So that's how it started. And then you go into the reserves, and then you try and get into the first team. That was the way out.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I know who to have by my side when I need to go into the next crunch negotiation for my own business. I might be giving you a call, Tony, I think. So you obviously got into Forest, and then who was your debut against? The first thing,
the debut. It was an evening game against Aston Villa at Villa Park, and the team sheet went up at lunchtime, and I was in and playing, right. And so I rang my friends up and everything. I went to Villa Park, I think we created one all, or we beat them 1-0, I'm not really sure. But I had a really good game. I was named man of the match. I created the goal for us, and you know, that was the start. And then I played the following week at Portsmouth, played well again, and got man of the match again, and then that was the end of the season. So there I was. I had two great games, and then it's close season, pre-season, and then back for the following season, yeah, or the next season, and that's when things started to turn the wrong way, basically, yeah.
Let me ask a quick question there, Mark, if I may. As a villain myself, I've always been an Aston Villa fan from my childhood. What impression did Aston Villa make on you? Because they were a pretty colossal club at the time, weren't they? The late 70s, early 80s, and so on. Was it a big club to play against? What impression did they make?
Big stadium, big club. They got some good players. In fact, was it Ian Ross, came from Liverpool, who was Aston Villa captain, who was very well respected, and he was a player who'd been around, and he sort of gave me a glowing report after the game, right? It was all going well. It was flying well for the last two games of the season. As I said, things started to change when I came back to the new season, and that's when things started to change a little bit. Now, whether it was I thought I'd made it, you know, and I didn't need to work as hard, or I probably wasn't fit enough, or something went wrong, and I started off in the first team, and I was terrible, right? So something had happened over those months, and then it was all going downhill, right?
What season are we talking, Tony?
Sorry?
What season was this, 77-78?
Oh, you'd have to have a look. Yeah, just before I broke through into the team, right? So I must have been 18. So then I had a year or so sort of fighting in the reserves, and then Cluffy came, then meeting up with Cluffy and all the Cluffy stories and stuff like that, which go on a little bit. But yeah, after a great start for me, and then not performing the following year as a young player, and then going downhill, you know, I had to get back on the slope again and start climbing up and start, you know, getting in the first team and start playing properly again, right? And then Cluffy came, and then, yeah, it was a tough time, yeah? But you've got to be able to battle through those moments, yeah?
That's right. And you actually went out and looked a couple of times, I think, when Cluffy first came in as well, I believe.
Yeah, when Cluffy first came, and his very first game, I think it was a cup game at Crystal Palace, Viv Anderson had played at the weekend for the first team, and then the squad went up, and Vic was out of the squad, and I was in it. And I thought, wow, that's not bad, right? This guy knows what he's talking about. So we head out to London to Bisham Abbey, and I'm thinking, well, I've got a chance of playing here. We get to Bisham Abbey, we go as Woodcock, go and get the balls, go and get the bibs, go and do this, go and do that. So I suddenly thought, well, I'll probably not be playing, but I might have a chance of sitting on the bench. So still training, and I'm doing all the jobs for around the team, and then this is the day of the game, I think it was, right? Day of the game at lunchtime. And we're all sitting having lunch, and then Cluffy comes in and he looks at me and he's got his keys in his hand to his room. He goes, young man, here's the keys to my room. He says, outside the door is my pair of shoes. I want you to go inside my room, then outside of the bed, some polish, and I want you to give them a good clean because I want to look my best tonight at Tottenham. So I thought, well, stand up for yourself. And I said, I'm having lunch, boss. And he said, in that, I won't do the accent, he says, I might be, I might be effing stupid, young man, but I'm not effing blind. Here's the keys. So I looked for a bit of support along the table, you know, of all the seasoned pros, and they all put their heads down. They left me, right? So there was one guy there who's called George Lyle, who George sort of looked at me and said, go on, mate, you know, off you go, go and do it. So got the keys out of his hand, went up, shoes in front of the door, went in, polished his shoes, came back down. By then, the rest of the players had gone. And the coach was there, a guy called Jimmy Gordon. And he said, don't worry about it. And he used to do this with Gordon McQueen at Leeds United. And he's a good player. Yeah. Which didn't quite make sense, right, to me, right? Plus he came and he goes, thanks very much, you'll go far, right? And I'm thinking, I want to be a footballer. I don't want to be a butler, yeah? What happened that night? I didn't play. I wasn't on the bench. Cluffy looked good. Nottingham Forest win 1-0, and that was the start of Cluffy's reign. Yeah,
right. Yeah, yeah. And then I guess Peter Taylor joined him a little bit later after he'd been at Forest for a while, didn't he?
Yes, he did. But before that, if you don't mind me saying as well, like, I went to see Cluffy, and he said, oh, I've seen you for a couple of weeks. I said, can I have a word with you? He said, right, what do you want? So come to the office. So I went to the office. He said, what do you want? I said, well, you know, I don't like playing on the left-hand side. I'm a lateral left-footed player, and everyone sticks me on that left wing, which I don't want to play there. He goes, well, where do you want to play? So I said, well, you know, I think what's going to be the best for the team and myself if I'm behind the front two and in front of the midfield. And I still smile at this one. I hear people saying this today, right? And he looks at me and he goes, and he says, that tells me two things, young man. One, you're too lazy to play in midfield, and he's getting louder now. And two, you're not brave enough to play up front. Get out. So he's thrown me out of the office, right? So that goes on.
Fantastic.
So there I am. And then a couple of weeks later, I'm playing for the reserves and everything. And every time he comes to a reserve game, he's shouting, he's going, Woodcock, get your foot on the ball, get hold of it. And it was echoing around the stands because obviously it's not full. So yeah. I took up enough courage one day, he's just crossing the car park, and I went over to him. I said, boss, can I have a word? He said, what do you want? I said, well, you know, I'm doing all right. But then you turn up at the games and you start bellowing from the stand, and it puts me off my game, yeah? And he says, oh, so it might motivate you. I said, no, it's, you know, it puts me off. And he looked at me deep in the eyes and says, well, you can't win them all, can you? Turned around and walked off. And I was just standing in the car park, right? And that was the moment where I thought, I've got to forget Brian Clough, forget Nottingham Forest, forget all the things on the periphery of playing football and just get down to playing the game. So I started playing the game. For the reserves, that is, yeah. And I'm starting doing well, and the newspaper's saying, yeah, that young Woodcock, he needs another chance. He's playing well, etc., etc. And we go up to play Newcastle United reserves, and by now I'm getting a bit confident, and I've got a 3-day growth on my face, sort of nicely trimmed, yeah. And the reserve team trainer, coach John Sheridan, says, you better be good today, otherwise that's going to get back to the man, right? You know, I said, well, I'm not unshaven, it's all. Yeah, it's neat, yeah?
Yeah.
So we play Newcastle. I had a good game. I scored a, you know, if you don't mind me saying, I scored a brilliant volley. And we come back to Nottingham. He says, right, it's late Saturday night. You can have Sunday and Monday off, right? So I get a call then over the weekend saying, the manager wants to see you at 9 o'clock Monday morning. So where I was living then with my mum and dad on the outskirts of Nottingham, I had to get two buses. So I wasn't like 18 years of age, jumping into a Porsche and going down to the city ground. There was two buses to get me down there, yeah? So I get there 9 o'clock, go and knock on his door. He says, come in. I go in there. He says, sit down. He says, what about Saturday? What happened? I said, well, I played up front and I scored a nice goal. I'm thinking, nice goal. It was a brilliant goal, right? He's obviously heard about it, yeah? Nice goal. And then he looks at me and goes, I'm not talking about the game. I'm talking about your face. You turned up unshaven. I said, well, he said, I wasn't shaving. It was nicely trimmed and that. It's like a 3-day growth. He said, well, why are you doing that? I said, well, I wanted to be a bit different. He starts again. He says, young man, if you want to be effing different, then you come to this club and you score 3 goals every week. And if you come unshaven to this club and this team once again, you'll never play. Get out. So I'm now thrown out of the office for a second time. Yeah. So, I'm thinking now, I've got no chance, that's all this, so I ought to be going on loan somewhere. So, Lincoln City came for me, Graham Taylor, who then went on to manage Aston Villa in England. And it was Lincoln City, were top of the fourth division, flying high, big crowd, scoring lots of goals. So that went really well for me. And Cluffy hauled me back from there to play me at left back under a different name at Old Trafford for the reserves. Right? So I did that. Played well at Old Trafford as the most attacking left back in the history of football. And the referee came and said, you'll play for England one day. I don't know what you're about left back. So, and then I went to Doncaster Rovers straight after because I thought I enjoyed going on loan. I'm playing in front of crowds. I'm playing with, you know, old seasoned professionals. And Doncaster went well for me and they wanted to sign me. And I go back to Nottingham. By this time, Peter Taylor was there. And, they said to me, well, I thought I was going, right? And then we played in the Anglo-Scottish Cup against United. And I'm in the team with recently new signing, Peter Whitt.
Peter Whitt.
We scored, we clicked straight away. And as they say, you know, that was it, you know, off you went. I'm playing every week after that, yeah. So that was the start of it, yeah.
Of course, as a Villa fan, I'm pretty excited to hear the name Peter With. I mean, nobody can forget that the 1-0 he scored for Villa against Bayern Munich. I think it was...
You mean that one that bobbled off his shin, that one?
The one he nearly missed, yeah.
Yeah, bobbled off his shin, right, yeah. And we're all very pleased. All the Forest lads were pleased for him because he should never have left. It was just about money, and it wasn't an awful lot of money that we believe that Clough and Taylor should have accepted and give him the contract that he wanted, right? But they stood firm, and to be quite honest, then they had a massive amount of luck because they drafted Gary Birtles in, right? So they had the luck on their side there as well. But we're all very pleased for Peter because he's still a mate of ours, still in our group, that he went so well for him. Yeah,
yeah, he certainly had an interesting career as well. He's been the national team coach in Thailand as well. So you'd still keep in touch with Peter. But what was Graham Taylor like? Because for me, certainly, he was one of the great Aston Villa managers as well.
He was brilliant. He used to do some strange things at Lincoln City before we went out. He used to have this routine where everyone was ready to go out and you'd have to... You know, where your place was in this, there were like containers, I think, right? But, you know, this is why he used to do it. He used to stand up on your seat and bang the wall. So he'd be 1, 2, 3, 4, and banging and shouting. And this was like a ritual before you went out on the pitch. And of course, Lincoln was, they were flying high. So that was a strange thing. And what he did as well, which he was ahead of the game, so Graham had a lot of criticism he got in the past with England and Aston Villa, that he used to take us on to Sinsel Bank at Lincoln on the morning of the game before we had lunch and, stand in the positions where you're going to be playing. So he'd want me to be sort of walking around the penalty box, right, and thinking what I'm going to... They would be calling it later on in life, visualisation, right, getting it all together. But he was doing that, years before anyone was talking about stuff like that. And there was other things where we used to train hard and we'd have one day where... you'd have six-a-side teams. Whoever won the six-a-side would get points. Then you'd have throw the medicine ball over the crossbar, you got points. You'd have sprint tests, you got points. You'd have keep the ball up, you'd have points. You'd have all these points over a whole morning's training. And then whoever got the most points, and there was all the top two individual players who got the most points, you'd say something, right, tomorrow's going to be the final between you two. We'll see you in the morning. And we all thought it's going to be a run or it's going to be something like that. And he brought, can you remember that children's game, Kaplunk, where you pull the sticks out of the box?
Yes.
So it was one of those, that was the final game. So you can imagine the changing rooms, two players playing Kaplunk, followed with all the rest of the lads, and that was the final, and you won a little cup of Mars bars and stuff. So he was changing everything all the time, right, and doing different things, yeah? So, yeah, he was great. He got my confidence going again, and I would have stayed for him at any time, yeah.
Excellent.
That must have been great for the camaraderie between the lads, I think, having those sorts of games and environments.
It was brilliant. You know, when you're flying high and, they all respect the manager and the team's getting on well, it's a brilliant environment to be in, right? And yeah. He used to chat to me, says, where do you want to play? I really want to play up front because I've played a couple of games for him on the left-hand side and scored goals. And he said, he had a practice game on the Wednesday and he said, right, go and play up front. So I played up front and there was a guy called Sam Ellis who was the club captain, right? And Sam wasn't the quickest and, I've got a bit of pace with me and stuff like that. Anyway, practice game, I played up front and I roasted Sam, who was the club captain, for about, 45 minutes, and I got three goals in my, so we have the team talk. We're playing at Brentford against Lincoln City, and in the team talk before the game, he said, well, it's got to be one change today. I'm going to have Tony playing right up the middle, centre forward. And Sam Ellis, who was sitting behind me, he sort of leant forward and whispered in my ear, he said, there you are, son, I got you in the team, didn't I?
Amazing, incredible stories. I'd love to know whether you think he was one of the Graham Taylor was one of the best ever England managers. Italia 90 certainly for me struck a massive chord. The commitment of the players was incredible. Do you think we were unlucky not to go on and win Italia 90, Tony?
Yeah, well, you say, what's unlucky? You know, you play the game, right? You normally say you win championships and stuff because you deserve to win them, right? You know, it's what's a bit of unluck, you know, it's a bit of unluck, you know. If you get the chance, you've got to put the ball in the net, you've got to defend, right? So, you know, you've got to get there, haven't you? You know, it's the luck and no luck doesn't really come into it, right? You've got to get through it, yeah, get there, yeah.
So, absolutely right. And we'll be coming to England later on. I think but both Mark and I would be hugely thrilled to get to, really, I mean, you win the title. I mean, essentially what now is the Premiership, the old First Division title with Forest. And then, of course, yeah. I mean, you know, the dream of every single footballer. This is a Borussia Dortmund show. As you know, in 97, Borussia Dortmund won the Champions League in Munich, of all places, in the Olympiastadion. And no doubt, you know, that is the highlight of. I've interviewed Jörg Heinrich, Martin Kreh, other players who played in that team. And yeah, Tony, I mean, let's start with the old First Division title, essentially the Premier League. I mean, Liverpool have won it this season, the first time in 30 years. You'll have played a lot of games against Liverpool back in the day. They were a fantastic team in the 1970s. Do spill the beans a bit on that title run. Must have been huge to win something that impressive.
Oh, yeah, it's great. Well, it starts off where you're in the second division when club is there, and we go up in, I think, it's third place in the so-called second division, right? And the story is that club used to take us to Mallorca, you know, once, twice, three times a year to get her out of it. And we're flying to Mallorca for end of season break. And that day, I think it was Wolves were playing Bolton Wanderers. And either the draw or something like that for us to go up to then the first division. So we're on the plane and the captain says, right, the game's kicked off. I'll give you some information when we can. And we're landing in Mallorca. And the captain said before we come to a halt on the runway, told us the result. They said, congratulations, Nottingham Forest, you've just got promotion to the first division, as we landed on the runway in Mallorca.
Wow.
For a few days, all the lads together. So you can imagine what that was like, yeah?
Amazing.
So we just scraped up with our teeth, and then things started to happen pretty quickly then. You know, Peter Shilton came, Kenny Burns came, Archie Gemmell came, started moving quick, and we started playing, and we just went from strength to strength. Playing our first game was at Everton at Goodison, and it took us about, you know, 10 minutes to get used to it, the pace, the atmosphere and everything like that. But once we settled down, you know, we're a good team, you know, we weren't bad at door, right? And, you know, we just went on. Everyone kept saying the bubble's going to burst. It never did, right? It got bigger and bigger, yeah? So, yeah, it was good times.
Absolutely, and an amazing run. I mean, I think it stunned, you know, the whole of the country, really, as you say, because just getting up into the first division itself was an achievement, and then I'd imagine expectations were that, you know, I guess, you know, survival number one, and then even sort of like a mid-table finish would have been great. But as you say, to go on and lift the title, absolutely incredible, and at a time when you had such a dominant side like Liverpool.
Even though we'd only just gone up by the skin of our teeth, right? You know, survival and, you know, hoping to be mid-table never came into it, right? We're getting out there. You're good players, right? We're getting stronger. Let's go and see what this first division is about, sort of thing, right? And, you know, we did. And we went on that, was it 42 game unbeaten run? When Arsenal were doing it with the Invincibles, right, I got Viv Anderson calling me saying they have now used something like 32 players, right? The pitch is looking like a carpet, and even at the end of the season, and all those things you get thrown in, like, yeah, and, you know, and we did it with, what, about 15 players or something, on ice, on mud, you know, in torrential rain and everything, yeah, so, it was a good time to get there, right? So we just went on, you know, strength to strength, and then when it came to the European Cup games and stuff like that, you know, we were all excited to go and play football in Europe. So what happens when the draw's made? You know, we've got the champions of Europe, Liverpool, against the English champions, Nottingham Forest. In those days, as we all know,
you have to be European champions or your country's champions to actually qualify for the European Cup. There's no way finishing fourth and having a goal and being able to play in the group and lose a few games, you know, and still make it to the final. You had to win. Every game was on aggregate. If you lost that game, you're out. Yeah, so...
What a classic tie that was. I remember that game. I mean, I remember the City Ground pitch. It used to get waterlogged, you know, so easily, especially as you say, compared to today's pitches. And so you won the first leg 2-0 against Liverpool.
Yeah.
I think a certain person assisted both goals in that game.
Yeah, you're right. With the second one, Colin Barrett, you know, that will go down as one of the Forest fans' favourite goals, obviously, yeah. You know, putting a 2-0 lead against Liverpool at that time, and the goal itself, it was a nicely worked goal. You know, and Colin smashed it in, right? You know, you couldn't catch him after that. You know, as quick as he's moved in years, yeah?
Absolutely incredible.
Absolutely.
Incredible. Say, Mark, that the same feat was achieved, because I always like to compare and contrast. Mark is the... Premier League expert, and I kind of fancy myself as a bit of a aficionado of the Bundesliga, but the remarkable Otto Rehagel, who you remember won the European Championship with Greece, Tony, achieved the same fate with Erste FC Kaiserslautern 1990, coming up from the Zweite Liga and then going on to win the Bundesliga title. A remarkable... I'm really very interested to hear your Bundesliga recollections as well. Let's talk about the European Cup, Mark, because, I mean, my God, winning the Champions League, I mean, doesn't get any bigger than that, does it?
Well, that's right, exactly. And I suppose to start, really, is maybe obviously going through and getting past Liverpool was a big, big victory for Forest. But what about the semi-final? I mean... And obviously, you know, as we go on with Tony's career, the semi-final, drawn to play against FC Cologne, and that first leg, I mean, what a stunning game that was at the City Ground.
Yeah, it would be nice to watch that, you know, for the 90 minutes, because it was an unbelievable game, right? And leading up to the game, Peter Taylor said, yeah, we've seen Cologne, they've got no pace, we're going to be fine, right? They've got a goalkeeper who can't. Who just wants to thump this, and so he went through it like that. And then we went and played, and we started off badly because I think it was Archie Gem got an injury, and that sent the whole team out of sync. Right, I think Ian Bowyer had to move, and then Frank Clark moved around, and we had about a 10 or 15 minute spell where, you know, we used to pride ourselves on being able to keep a clean sheet. Right, if things got tough against us, right? So suddenly they're 2-0 up, right? And we've never been 2-0 down. We're in shock, in a state of shock, and thinking, well, perhaps they're not as good as we think we are, right? And the pitch, you saw the pitch, what it was like, and it didn't bother the Cologne lads. You know, they were reveling in it, basically, yeah. And they were 2-0 up, and Roger Van Gool went through, and he just clipped, or just went on the outside of the post where. I always say, if that would have gone in, you know, we could have been dead and buried there at 3-0. But we're a good team, good players. Yeah, we started to fight our way back, and we get back to we're in the lead 3-2. And then obviously the Okudiri, yeah, with his shot that went underneath Peter Shilton because he was expecting to bounce up, but he didn't. You know, puts it on a 3-0 draw where everyone thought, except Brian Clough, that's it, we're out of it. Yeah. So
yeah. Yeah, and then obviously the second leg to go over to Cologne, and you did exactly what you, I guess, just described, managed to keep a clean sheet out there.
Yeah, well, we went over to Cologne, we were there a couple of days before the game, right? And like most clubs, go and have a look at the stadium and the pitch. You know, that wasn't in Cluffy. Cluffy says, it's a football pitch. We've been all around the world. We know what they're like. We don't need to do that. And we're staying in the Queen's Hotel. Where's that? Not far from the stadium. So we just got a walk in the park there. I don't think we actually trained, we went for a bit of a jog. So, and then we'd have a few beers at night and play cards and stuff like that. And this is relevant because when I joined Cologne, I was staying in that hotel before I got an apartment or anything, yeah? So what happened is that I met the manager and I met the staff and everything because I was staying there. And they then kept saying to me, listen, we lost all our month's money, right, on that game because Cologne played 3-3. Nottingham Forest come over to the hotel. They don't train. They don't go to the stadium. They just do a bit of a walk and a jog and then fluff around. And then they're having a few beers and glasses of wine at night and playing cards. There is no way that this mob are going to beat FC Cologne, right? So they put all the money on FC getting to the final. And of course, we go there and Cluffy says, it's got to be a tight game, lads. You know, if we get the chance, we'll put one in the net, of course, but we'll keep it to 0-0 at half-time. And then 20 minutes into the second half, we'll go one up and then we'll shut up shop and then we'll get back to Nottingham and celebrate the next day. And this is exactly what happened, yeah? And this is what gave him the power with the players, because he'd say things like that. And, you know, you'd go out and happen. I know you need the players to do it, but, you know, strange things like that, they kept happening. It gave a belief then, you know, for not only the management, but for the players as well.
Absolutely, yeah, remarkable.
And then the final against Malmo, I think, if I remember rightly, I think Forest were quite strong favourites to win the game. Swedish side. And a game that I think, you know, Forest pretty much dominated, certainly in terms of possession of the ball. But it was still a fairly tight affair because obviously there weren't many goals in the game.
We were all disappointed, right? All the players were disappointed because we wanted to put a show on. And Malmo came and they defended well. And I mean, I got in a bit of trouble. I was in the press conference afterwards and I'd said something. I wasn't trying to be detrimental, but I said, listen, when you're defending and you're all defending, it's difficult. And it was a hot, sticky evening as well. And I said, if you put 11 dustbins out, right, you know, 30 yards from goal, right, or you call them cones now or whatever, or you know, mannequins or whatever, and you have to play through them without them moving, it's difficult, yeah? Mm. You understand what I'm saying, right? So if you've got 10 dustbins and then one in the goal and you've got a ball and you say, right, we'll play through the dustbins without touching them at pace. It's not that easy, yeah? But when they can move as well, it makes it even harder, right? You know, so if someone's set up nicely to break them down, you know, it's difficult. We were disappointed the way we played because we didn't put a show on. And it could have been, you know, we had two or three chances we might have put away, but we went in the changing room afterwards and Brian Clough and Peter Taylor said, look, lads, you've had a fantastic whole tournament. You know, don't be down here because we didn't put a real show on, right? He said, you've been brilliant for the whole year. And that perked us up a little bit then, right? So then it was, you know, time to celebrate in Munich and then the next day in Nottingham, yeah?
I have to say, Tony, that this is something quite remarkable from the 97 Borussia Dortmund team that won that Champions League. I interviewed three of the players, Pedersen, Heinrich and Martin Kreh. Martin Kreh, fantastic bloke, I have to say. I don't know if you met Jörg Heinrich. I'm sure you probably came across him.
Yeah, I've come across him in the past, yeah.
But it's very similar, the way talking to you and talking to them. The details of the game somehow, he said, Jörg Heinrich's words were, it took me years before I could actually remember very much at all about that night. It seems as if I've watched so many World Cup finals and so on. I remember the Italy one. Which one was that, Mark, where they won 1-0 Italy? The finals they're so hard fought and they're so intense and so on. And you can just see that, you know, to come away with the goods, I mean, is something quite remarkable. As an Aston Villa fan, I'd certainly be interested to know what was Martin O'Neill like, because he, for me, was one of the best ever Aston Villa managers, and he was on the substitute bench at with the Forest team. Was he someone that you were mates with, Martin O'Neill?
Yeah.
What was he like as a character?
We're all very close, even today. And I still see Martin when he calls me and stuff like that. We're all very close. In fact, I sort of, you know, they're known in Nottingham as the Miracle Men, right? Because a film came out called I Believe in Miracles. So the group, about 18 players, are called the Miracle Men. So I sort of look after that group. You know, I've got early emails, and if there's anything to do with the club or anything else, right, you know, I sort of organise it for them because he was too spread out with everything, right? So I took that on hand for all that, right? So, there was at the final, because Trevor Francis was allowed to play in the final. He wasn't allowed to play in any of the games, only the final. So, is Trevor going to play? Is Martin O'Neill going to play? Is Archie Gemmell going to play? And I think Frank Clark. They've all got little niggly injuries, right? So Martin didn't make the team, and Trevor came in for his very first European Cup, and only European Cup game, right, which he scored in. I can just throw you this stat in as well, right? I've got two European Cups because I left, I think it must have been just before the quarterfinals, and the statistic is, if you don't mind me saying, we're blowing my own trumpet here, is that I'm the only Forest player who's never lost a game in the first and the second European Cup campaigns, right? It was only when they had the first loss, I think, to, was it Berlin or to Ajax in the quarterfinals and semifinals. I joined Köln then. I was in Cologne. So leading up to that, in all the previous games and the previous campaign, we never lost a game. So that's a stat for you.
That's a remarkable stat.
A nice one you can sort of, when you're chatting with the lads in that group, then you can sort of, you can poke them.
Yeah. Exactly. Don't worry about that. They get that. You know, I mean, this bunch of lads, a good bunch of lads, they can celebrate as much as they could play on the field as well, right? And it was important, this where you're all together, right? And he's still there today, right? We're still all mates today, yeah.
Trevor Francis, what kind of guy was Trevor Francis? The first £1 million player, in fact. And you, Tony, were, I believe, the first million Deutschmark player when you moved to Germany to FC Cologne.
I don't think it was a million because it was a UEFA ruling, right? My age, it was the most that an English club could ask for with this UEFA ruling, which was about 2 million Deutschmarks or something like that, yeah?
Yeah, just under. About 700,000.
But it was a German record, and it was bit of hoo-ha about it all and that. But from my point of view, it was, they could have got more money for me from Manchester United if I moved in England. So, like today's young players coming to Germany, it's not a risk because the financial deal that's involved with it. He'll be sold back to an English club for exactly the same money. Are you going to make a profit on him, whether he plays well or doesn't play well? But that's diverting a bit. Trev, he came, he was one of the lads. Brian Clough made sure that, he knew his place amongst all the lads and that it should be his privilege to be able to play in this team, right, and to play with such players. And Trev's great. Trev was fine with it all. In fact, Trev always said, we used to play well up front, Trev and myself. We played a few games for England, a couple of games for England up front. It always went very well. And Trev always wanted to say the two of us playing up front, but we'd also got Gary Birtles. So Trev ended up playing on the right, which still wasn't bad. So we had Francis playing out wide on the right, and then we've got Woodcock and Birtles up front, the two. So, we all speak together. We're still in regular contact. And so, we're all still very tight-knit group.
Did you keep the shirt, Tony? The Adidas red shirt from the final?
It must be somewhere around. It must be in my children or my ex-wife's have got it or somewhere.
And please go ahead.
I'm not one to have, shirts and pictures and football and that, hanging around. So they're in a bag somewhere, I think. Like England caps are in a cupboard somewhere, yeah?
Yeah.
It's not like a museum, put it that way. I don't want it to be like a museum, right, with all that stuff around, right? Medals and caps and shirts and that. I'm not really into all that, yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. I mean, it must have been a wrench when the time came, I suppose, to leave Forest.
Yeah, I was being chased, it was all very cloak and dagger. I got, no one knew about them in those days. I got agents, got foreign agents who were from Belgium coming through and saying, we've got clubs in Italy for you, Spain, and blah, 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 Germany, and I can remember Kevin was in Germany, Kevin Keegan was in Germany. I spoke to Kev and he says, be careful that they're not touting you around everywhere and stuff like that. There was one guy in particular who was on the deal and, very cloak and dagger. I arrived at Heathrow with Nottingham Forest And a porter comes over to me while I'm waiting for the bags to come out and says, "Oh, Mr. Woodcock, and stuck something in my top pocket until I've been asked to give you this." I went and I got a name and a telephone number to call. And it was a Belgian agent who said, then I rang the number and he came to Nottingham and said, "Cologne are interested, and other clubs are interested. Would I be interested in going?" And that's how it started off, right? And I hadn't signed a contract at Forest, and they were offering me contracts. And then it was getting the thought process was, I've won quite a, you know, individual awards, and then we've won things in the team now. We've got the European Cup stuff going on. We've won the league. We've won all that. And I'd seen how Kevin had gone on in Germany, and yeah, there was much more money to be earned by moving abroad as well. And all those things came into it, learning a language, you know, a different culture, and it was all coming to a head, right? So, yeah, that's how it all started. Yeah.
So I guess you're then essentially, after your 700,000 transfer, remarkable transfer, you're then in the territory of the Bundesliga, which is my territory, I guess, by the league that I'm so fascinated by. And I lived in Germany between... I'm aging myself now, between 1983 and 1990-91, and had a season ticket at Borussia Dortmund. And so Tony will have seen a lot of your games, and obviously as an Englishman I was particularly pleased to see an English player on the pitch in the Bundesliga. Dortmund honestly didn't have a very good relationship with FC Cologne, partly because Cologne would come and thump us, and Dortmund were a pretty weak team at the time. But, I used to buy that Kicker Sport, you remember the Kicker Sport magazine, the annual, Bundesliga Saisonheft, you know, which had all the teams in it and so on. And I remember you very distinctly with that white Adidas shirt with the red stripes, and Toni Schumacher, Pierre Littbarski, and all the team and so on. One of our members, Max, who isn't available to be on the show tonight, asked, did you feel a lot of pressure by being welcomed, apparently, by 4,000 supporters at the airport or so when you arrived? Or was it at your first training game?
There's more than that, I think. I landed in Frankfurt and went to Frankfurt versus Köln again. And that was obviously a long hoorah there at the airport and then at the stadium itself. And the next day, my first training session at the Geisbockheim, I'm being picked up by Hannes Lohr, and he's taking me there, and I'm thinking, you know, what are these cars here? You know, what's all this for? Right? 'Cause we trained at Nottingham Forest. It was very private, you know, down the field, down the side of the River Trent, yeah? No one was there, yeah? You're lucky if you saw two people. And I was sort of saying, well, what's happening here? And Hannes Lohr said, they're here to see you. You know, apparently there was 10,000 people there, the Franz Kramer Stadium. But well, they see me train. Is that all? Yeah. So, there's been that much press and everything leading up to it. Yeah, so that was my introduction to, you know, the Bundesliga and, you know, what was happening at the Geisbockheim. And the Geisbockheim was incredible because every day at training, not just because of me or anything like that, there was hundreds of people there. There were, every day there's people watching training, right? Yeah.
So you're signing a lot of shirts. Signing a lot of autographs there. A great adulation, a great football club, FC Cologne, and by now very good relations between the FC Cologne and Dortmund fans, which is partly why it's so cool to have you on the show, but also because Mark and I are very huge England fans as well, and we'll be coming to England later on. My half-brother in Germany, Benny, who lives in Kiel, was really keen to know what was Litti like, Pierre Littbarski. I mean, really, he was incredible on skills-wise on the ball, wasn't he? A very short guy, though.
It's his birthday a few weeks ago. I texted him, but just reminding me now, I scored my very first goal for FC against Dortmund.
Oh, outstanding. At the Westfalenstadion?
I think it was in Cologne. I think we beat them 3-0. the header as well, of all things.
that Mark, was what it was like most of the time against FC Cologne. Teams like Werder Bremen and FC Cologne were kicking our ass throughout the 80s. It was pretty depressing at times. I'm sure, Tony, you remember playing in Dortmund at the Westfalenstadion in front of quite meagre crowds. I mean, it wasn't like now. You didn't get 80,000 at Dortmund. You know, they were lucky to get sort of 20, 25,000 most of the time. And I'm very proud to have been part of that era, because it makes it all the more special to see Dortmund right up at the top of their game now, having been there when they were really quite weak in the early 80s.
A lot of delights in Cologne. There's still a lot of former players in Cologne, so it's great when I go back there. And we always said, they say, if they had the chance of playing now in the stadium at Cologne, right, with 50,000 and really close to the pitch, what a pleasure, what difference it would make. When we played in the Mungersdorf Stadium, that if we were expected to beat the team, right, the fans wouldn't turn up, and we're expected to beat most of them. So you'd only get it full if you got Bayern Munich there or a local derby or something, because you're expected to win. And again, if you weren't playing well, you'd be whistled. You just expect the expectation of the fans in that. And if I joined FC Cologne, they were just double winners. They won the cup and the league.
That's right.
So the fans were spoiled with success. Then I turn up, and they expected that if you're playing someone like Erdingen, that FC will beat them. That's not. We don't need to go and watch, right? And if you weren't performing, right, then they'd be whistling away at you and everything. Yeah. So there's a bit of pressure on you. But that's what it's like if you're at, or what it used to be like when you're at, a big club and you've got some top name players playing. Yeah.
And Mark will remember the 1982 World Cup, and we'll certainly be coming to that later on, because Mark and I had a chat yesterday, and both of us were very impressed with that team, that England team. And a player that was very he went on to actually become goalkeeping coach at Borussia Dortmund, but let's be quite frank, he was very much an FC Cologne legend. And Germany legend, of course, is Toni Schumacher. And how could we ever forget that? Well, perhaps we ought to forget it, that match against France at the 82 World Cup. But was Tony really, did he have a temper on him, or was that just a one-off, you think, when he punched Battiston in the face? I mean, it was a mistake, I think.
You have to hear his side of the story for that. And I don't want to, his side of the story is a little bit different, right? Then he caught him, obviously, right? He's come out a little bit rushed. He's lost his positioning and so, and he's gone and smashed into him, right? He said, I lost all my bearings. And he said, what happened as well after that? Because he got a lot of stick about, juggling with the ball in the net while the other guy was being carried off. He said, but he was left by himself. No one, whether it was the German team or the French team, went to him to sort of say what's happening there. And, Tony tells a few stories about that, that he went to apologise to him a number of occasions, and he apparently... in France, when he was all arranged for him to go to a hotel and meet him face to face and apologise and stuff like that. And Tony was in one room, and he's asked to go in the next room, and there's a full blown press conference. So he's put into it. So, every story, as they say, has three sides to it. Yeah. So although it didn't look very nice, and he caught him obviously, and he smashed him, right? If you listen to Tony's side of it, right? He'll say, he's out of order. He didn't actually mean to go out there and smash him and do him as it looked like that. He just got all his, his bearings mixed up and stuff like that, But he's better as he tells the story rather than me, right, But, he's just passionate about his position in goal, right, wanting to win. We had a couple of ups and downs, right. I can remember once, he likes to throw the ball out at distance, and if we're under pressure, he'd get it and he'd smash it upfield, and I'm there fighting two defenders off, right? I'm holding one off and the other one's got his arms around me and I'm fighting it, right? And he said to me once at half time, I jumped up off the bench at half time and went over to him and threatened him, right? I mean, he's threatening Tony Schumacher, all in German, and saying that you're the only goalkeeper in the world who, that when we're under pressure, grabs the ball instead of holding it, let it calm down, whacks it up to me, and I'm fighting sometimes three defenders to try and hold on to the ball, and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, he was quiet, and played the second half, and going back to the Geisbockheim, which we used to, from the Mungersdorf to the Geisbockheim on the coach, and I was with Ben Coleman, and he smiled at me. He said, "Oh, good German, yeah." I said, "Nice. Did you understand all that?" He said, "Oh, yeah, we all understood it exactly right, yeah." So they totally didn't speak. He just sit across from me in the changing rooms, yeah, at training ground. He didn't speak to me for 2 days. And then the third day he came in, we both looked at each other and smiled, and a big hug and a kiss, and everything's back to normal, yeah. So, no, he's fine. Fine, no problem. You'd rather have him on your team than against you, yeah. So,
remarkable.
Good guy, good goalkeeper, you know, there's nothing wrong with someone wanting to win and be passionate about it and stuff like that, yeah.
That's remarkable. From my own just very brief recollection, my mum married a German, but she had children with him, my brother Oscar, and so on. We moved to Germany to live in Dortmund. I was at the British Army School. As you remember, Tony, there was a British Army presence in Germany at the time, very big British Army presence. And I remember first Christmas out there, I think it was 83. The brother of my stepfather turned up with a blue Germany national team, Toni Schumacher's shirt. So I'm quite glad he ended up joining Borussia Dortmund after a while for a time. But the 81-82, I mean, I think one would have to talk about that. Basically, essentially, you missed out only by 3 points to HSV for the title. Pretty remarkable. That must have been quite a disappointment, I guess, amongst your many highlights, because you were a top scorer with 15 goals.
Yeah, the thing is, Rinus Michels were there, and Rinus Michels, virtually every game we played, yeah, the squad of 16 was 16 international players. So you've got 11 on the field and the rest sitting on the bench, right? So you've got Rinus Michels there. Rinus, he used to work as hard. He said, "I know you can play football. Don't need to do that. We work hard, right?" So we did a lot of running. I remember Pierre Lebowski coming in one day and saying, "Trey, you know, you could do a little bit of shooting and a bit of crossing and stuff." He said, "We start at 10 o'clock. If you get in at 9, you can do a little bit before training, or you can do it after." So he was tough, but he was good, right? And we're going to be champions, and I don't think we really believed we could be, because there was a lot of stuff going on, you know, with Rinus, about how hard we were training and stuff and this and that and everything. So this came up a few weeks ago with a podcast for Edward Leenan, yeah? He was on, and he was saying...
Edward Leenan, absolutely. Yeah.
We lost this game, a home game, to Bielefeld, where we pounded them for 90 minutes and we couldn't put the ball in the net, right? You could say unlucky, as you said before, but no, it's not. We didn't put the ball in the net. And then Edward goes up there from the halfway line, runs to the penalty box, and then dives into it, right? And they get a penalty, and they beat us 1-0. And we didn't probably thought, if we would have won that game, we could have easily gone on to be champions, right? That's the whole thing, yeah? And then the final game of the season, I think we played at Braunschweig, and... it was 4-4, right? But if we would have won that game against Bielefeld and then gone into whatever the next game was, which I don't know which one it was, and then the final one in Paris, like, yeah, we could have easily been champions. Yeah? But I'm not sure if we, after that defeat, if we really believed that we could do it, right? But, yeah, we come close, right? And so, shame.
But needless to say, I mean, it's very well known that HSV at the time were an incredible team that won the European Cup against Liverpool. I think it was in the final in Athens. Felix Magath scored the goal. And, of course, Felix Magath went on to be manager of Fulham. And they were an incredible team. They had the amazing Horst Rubesch up front, huge, big, ugly guy. Later on went to play for Borussia Dortmund for a season, didn't particularly work out. But, yeah, it was a remarkable HSV team. I mean, as I said, Magath, Uli Stein, one of the best goalkeepers ever, for me at least, in the Bundesliga. Dietmar Jakobs.
Yeah,
remarkable.
They've got a few players, yeah.
Certainly, absolutely remarkable. Did you have a good friendship with Kevin Keegan? I mean, I guess he must have persuaded you, because Max pointed out that the Spanish and Italian clubs were chasing you at the time and you chose to go to Germany. Jude Bellingham's a young talent from Birmingham City, who's recently moved to Borussia Dortmund. Is very thrilled to see him come over. Anything to say, I mean, basically about being an Englishman in Germany? I mean, you're obviously very, very fond of Germany.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a trend now, isn't it, right? I can remember saying this many years ago, right, about the young players who were not been given a chance in England, that perhaps some of the European clubs should be looking at them. And as I said before, it's not just how you're going to play the game, but it's also a financial structure which the German clubs can't really lose. So what you've got at the moment, and I can remember saying this many years ago, but also when it was Lukas Podolski's final game in Dortmund, Germany versus England, and Podolski scored his final game, I was there, I was invited by the DFB and the English FA for lunch beforehand and everything, and I was speaking to Herr Banske, and I said, you should be looking at young English players, because if you get them over, and whatever they're going to cost, right, if they don't, come up to expectation and play as you want them to, you're not going to lose any money on them. In fact, you might make money on them. He said, the only problem we have on that is that the young English players are earning three times as much as our players. But that seems to have changed a little bit now, where there's quite a few English lads who are now, playing in the Bundesliga or with Bundesliga clubs, which is good for them. It's good for their education to see something different, learn a different language, different culture. But there's also the financial aspect of it. I think we've seen it with, I can't remember what the guy's name is, he went from Nottingham Forest to Red Bull Leipzig. He didn't quite make it. He wasn't up to 800%.
Oliver Burke? Was it Oliver Burke? I think it's Oliver Burke, wasn't it? Good player, actually.
Wasn't quite up for it, and he goes back there, so it didn't cost them anything. They got the money back, but if he would have been successful, as you can see with like Sancho at the moment, so it looks like you're paying 10 million euros to Sancho or whatever it is, and plus what he's earning and that, it's a lot for a youngster, but now you're looking at 100 million, right? It's a great financial deal for them. So now, you can see which way it's going in that, right? So
I can see which way it's going, and I can also see that we've been chatting for a while, Tony, and I know that Mark is, he would shoot me literally if I didn't let you come to the Arsenal episode of your career, and you're a gooner, sir. I was talking to Mark Brindle, I was talking to Josh Landy, who does the Arsenal podcast earlier. I asked him if he had any questions for you. The SLO at Arsenal, where Mark Brindle, we had him on the show a couple of weeks ago. Mark and I absolutely chatted. You're a brilliant bloke, absolutely brilliant bloke. And you are I was looking you up. You are ranked in the top 75 of best ever Arsenal players. I think you should be far, far higher up than there. But what do I know about Arsenal? We've got another little bit of Bundesliga, which we'll come to, which will be slightly briefer, I have to say. And then we'll just finish off with your England career, which is an essential. Fantastic. Let me pass you over to Mark for the Arsenal episode, Tony.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Ben. So I know at the time, Tony, when you were at FC Cologne, you were looking to come back to England, and I guess probably to sort of help your own England career, I imagine. But you, aside from Arsenal, you had, I think, United, Liverpool, and maybe Leeds as well. I think at the time we're chasing after you. I'm curious, first of all, why did you choose Arsenal?
Well, first of all, you're right. I'm playing. It was asked earlier on why did I go in the Bundesliga, because at that time when I was playing there, the Bundesliga was probably the strongest league in Europe with all the best players playing in there, and they needed two foreign players. So the foreign players in those days, because you're only allowed two, were always top foreign players, right? So that's one of the reasons to go to Germany, right? To go to the Bundesliga, because it was the best players were there and the best league at the time, right? So, Arsenal. Why Arsenal? Yeah, because even though I was being called up for England, no one was coming out to watch me play. As I say, in probably the best league in Europe, playing with some great players and playing well, no one was coming out, so I was getting called back. So I had a long-term plan, which to say, right, after the Cologne, I'm going to go back to England and then play for whoever I'm going to play for, and then start playing regularly in the England team. And then the plan would be then in 1984 or just after that to then go back into Europe, whether it was Spain or Italy or somewhere else, after the European Championships. I believe they were in France. So I go back to England. I join Arsenal because Arsenal had been chasing me for the previous 2 years. They kept coming over, Terry Neal and Don Howe, and ask you how we're going on and how's this happening, and you know, we want to get you signed. And so they kept on, they did the homework and kept on. And the fact is as well that London was appealing to me as well, right? I fancied living in London, yeah, stuff. So I go back, I play for Arsenal, play well for Arsenal, I'm playing for England, I'm playing scoring goals for England, everything's going great. But we don't qualify for the European Championships. So then I re-signed again for Arsenal and stayed there and then came back to Cologne. So it was a long-term plan that had to change in the middle. But the reasons for Arsenal were that they kept on at it. The tradition of the club, obviously when you know a club wants you, then you do a bit of research and look into the history and what you've known about it and stuff. And, you know, it was very much appealing, the history and the players who have played for them and what everyone said about Arsenal Football Club as well. And then the fact that they behaved themselves and tried to sign me, and now they were doing it all, and it's in, you know, it's in London. So that was the main pulling power of them, right? Yeah. And then I've got a long-term plan where it would be like a stepping stone for me to move to Spain or Italy at a later date, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think one of the biggest impressions that that people have always had is when you take that first step through the marble halls at the old Highbury. I think it made such a huge impression on people, on the away players and away manager, and certainly the Arsenal players when they first walked through there. I think it's one of the things for me as a fan, and I kind of miss elements of the old Highbury now. And I'm sure you've probably been to the Emirates Stadium on many occasions. And, you know, does it feel very different for you?
Yeah, of course it is, right? It's a sport franchise now. If you want to get into all that sort of stuff, it's not the old Arsenal and custodians of the badge. And if you look at Highbury, the facade of the East Stand, is it? Or the East Stand, the West, the East Stand, you know, where you're tightly knitted in Avril Street and all the surrounding streets and stuff, and on a big day how packed it was going down there. And you thought about that being in the old days as well, what it used to be like. And then you've got all that little added bit of class where you've got, you know, Nobby the doorman who stood at the steps, you know, in his full uniform, and all those little things that went with the club, right? Now, there were little things like, you know, if the weather was hot, right, you weren't allowed to wear a short-sleeved shirt unless the whole team wore short sleeves, right? So the captain had to decide, or captain, you know, if someone didn't like short sleeves, so no, you know, you have to play long sleeves. You couldn't mix them up. There was things about, you know, players shouldn't have mustaches. Yeah, up in the match days in the boardroom, right, when the directors and the away directors were there, the ladies would have to leave the director's room and go to the ladies' room while they had their cigars and their cognac, even at the Emirates today, I believe that when you go in the director's box, the tradition was always from Highbury into the Emirates, is that wherever you're playing, you have flowers of the colour of the opposition. So if you're playing Wolves, you've got black and yellow flowers. If you're playing Liverpool, you've got red flowers around, right? So that's another. But there's loads of these little traditions that were happening that made it appealing to play for Arsenal Football Club and be part of the history, you know, of a great club, you know, that's, you know, over 100 years old, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, obviously, at that time, I was following Arsenal home and away, going to all of the games. And I can't forget, obviously, the day out at Villa Park when he netted five and possibly could have had more, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, Villa Park has always been a good hunting ground for me. I didn't realise until every time it cropped up, you know, every so often, if Arsenal play, you know, Villa or somebody comes up with that. But I didn't realise he was only something like 49 minutes or something and got five goals. You know, I've still got a load of time, but after that, there wasn't one half chance that came my way. Paul Davies should have put me in, I thought, at one stage. But, you know, looking back on it, you know, you just played the game, right, and never thought about Ted Drake getting eight goals, and you could have possibly have done that and gone down in history, although it's gone down in history anyway. You know, but you look back on it, I think, well, I really, you know, I've got a good 30 minutes, right, you know, to, you know, put the goal tally up. But, you know, I think that shows the mentality of a real out-and-out goal scorer, someone like Dieter Müller and myself. I like scoring goals, I could put the ball in the net, but I thought I was a footballer as well, whereas Dieter Müller, to all the great players I've played with, he was just the absolute goal scorer. Yeah, he could play well, but he hasn't put the ball in the net. He's a misery. He could have a bad game, just touch one over the line, just tricky, you know, and he'll be happy as hell. Yeah.
Talking about
and I think him being there with half an hour to go and he's got five goals, I think his mentality would have kicked in and said, right, I want as many as possible today. Yeah.
Talking about.
And it's a strange day, wasn't it? Because Ian Rush also got five on the same day for Liverpool.
Yeah, he got five. Apparently, Rushy was really upset when he heard that got five.
I love that.
Really yeah, absolutely. And then talking of sort of just touching it over the line and Dieter Bulla, I mean, for me as an Arsenal fan, and back then I was probably about 16 and was the FA Cup semi final against United, which I know you touched one over, like, to put us in at least. And that was at Villa Park, and that game was a real sickener because at half time we're all standing in the whole tent, we're singing our heads off, and we're thinking, you know what, we're going to do this. United were a very strong side at that point, and obviously had knocked us out of the League Cup semi final over two legs previously. But then in that second half, I don't know how you guys felt in the Arsenal team then. That I always think that, and I had this argument with mate to United fans, that Norman Whiteside sort of tripped over his own feet in the penalty area to win them the penalty. And then, it changed the course of the game.
Norman Whiteside.
I can remember, we said at half-time, right, I can remember Kenny Sampson saying, it was calmed down at half-time. And I can remember Kenny thinking he shouldn't have been calmed down, right? You know, like, let's calm down. He thought he should have been wrapped up for us to get out for the second half. And it was said that, clear our lines early, right? The longer the game goes on, the better we're going to be. And unfortunately, I think it might be Chrissy White. I don't think he could have cleared it or something and knocked it straight to someone. And that next ball was, two balls later, into the back of the net for the winner for him, yeah. So, that was a disappointing one, yeah.
Whiteside went on to play for Real Mallorca. My parents live out in Mallorca. You mentioned Mallorca earlier. Tony, it's amazing how life has so many... it's all interwoven with all the stories. I used to live in Schloss Holte Stückenbrock, which was where Ewald Lienen was born and raised. I just wanted to briefly ask, I lived in Oxford for a long time. A fella I used to see a lot around there was Martin Keown. And, a lot of people may say, the current generation may say, well, Tony Woodcock, that was a time back. But let's be frank. I mean, you were playing with guys like Tony Adams, Rocky Rocastle, these are guys that David O'Leary...
They hadn't broken through. They were young players, right? They hadn't broken through, but they were at Highbury when I was there. In fact, with Tony Adams, the occasion, if we trained at Highbury instead of London Coney, it might have been on a Friday or something like that. I might then just go out on the pitch and I'd take one of the young guys, take Tony Adams, and say, look, just knock some balls up to me, right? And I'd just turn on the edge of the box and, you know where you're going, It's always nice to have someone standing there. And Tony Adams' dad was there, so I said, "Can I put your dad in goal?" He said, "Yeah, he'd love that." Right? So we put Tony Adams' dad in goal.
Fantastic.
Tony's clipping the balls, and I'm taking them and turning and smashing them. Right. So in one position, one went in, and Mr. Adams has turned round to pick the ball up, right, from the back of the net. But as he's turned round, the second one's already on his way. Yeah, smashed him right in the face. He's broken his glasses and knocked him over. Yeah, that was his last time he did that. Yeah,
and big Niall Quinn, of course, an Ireland legend.
I knew Tony Adams. Sadly passed on, I believe.
Yes, I know.
But you had some big characters there as well. Because Viv Anderson obviously joined Arsenal, in the summer of 84, possibly, and Paul Mariner, Stevie Williams, and obviously Charlie Nicholas was at the club at the time you were there, but he never scored you.
No, well, Charlie's is writing a book at the moment. I've got some guy who's writing his books, ringing me up every day to say some stuff and everything. But I think this Arsenal team, if you go through it, you've got O'Leary at the back, you've got Pat Jennings, you've got Viv Anderson, Kenny Sampson, people like Alan Sunderland, Brian Talbot, Graham Ricks, Paul Mariner, myself, Charlie Nicklett. Yeah, I don't want to be detrimental to the coaching and the management staff and things like that, but players and characters were there, so it's important just to see how they could be moulded into a winning unit, which it wasn't. There were some good games and some awful games, right? So, you know, as I say, I don't want to press all the on the management, but that is when your greats come into it. People like Rinus Michels or Weisweiler or Clough. You got to think of the people I've been with. I've been with Weisweiler, Clough, Rinus Michels, Bobby Robson, Graham Taylor, yeah. Christoph Daum, Udo Lattic. Yeah, I've seen all a lot of them working, right? So when you look at the talent, and you suddenly think, why wasn't that formed into a successful group? Right, because there were some good players there, yeah.
Can I ask one question there? Just again, I mean, as an Aston Villa fan, if you like, David O'Leary, he went on to have quite a successful career as a manager, as a coach, and of course, Martin O'Neill as well. Could you foresee? I mean, how does it feel to you when you see these lads go on from remembering playing with them to becoming coaches and quite successful as well? Could you see that someone like Martin O'Neill was going to be a good coach later? I mean, did he have that sort of that kind of mentality, analytical mentality?
Of course he did. I think he was a trained lawyer, or trained to be a lawyer before he moved into football. Yeah, so he knew where he was going and what he was doing and stuff like that. He used to have a lot of arguments with Cluffy. Used to have a bit of fun with him with that. And what he did as well, which Cluffy always used to say, go and learn your trade. You start at the bottom and learn your trade before you work up. With Dave, Dave sort of moved in at a couple of big jobs straight away and got the structure around him. And if you've got, big jobs and good players around you, I'm not saying it's easy, but if it does jump together, right, you can have some success. Martin went down the lower leagues, and if you look at every club he's been with, he was successful with all of them. So he learned his trade, yeah.
A fantastic Aston Villa manager.
Absolutely. I think, was it very noticeable, do you think, Tony, from the sort of style of play that Arsenal were set up under, I suppose, particularly under Don Howe, versus sort of being under Cluffy at Forest or at Rinus Michels at Cologne? I mean, was it very noticeable, and was the training very different?
No, not really. Keep it down to basics, right? You want to see how it's 11 against 11, right? You've all got to do your little bit and stuff like that. And it depends what players you've got. Right, it sort of dictates the way you're going to play. Now, if you've got, two short centre forwards, it's going to be a waste of time, putting some high balls into the box, isn't it? Right, and vice versa. If you've got some big lump of a centre forward who just wants to go bosh and bash people about, it's pointless, letting him run and use the ball and move with it if you haven't got any pace. Right, so it's depending on what you've got dictates, how you're going to be playing, and then how you build the team and how do you want to play. And what players have you got? Don had a reputation of being defensive. I never really thought that. As I say, the best teams, you need to be able to keep a clean sheet. It's no use scoring three and having four scored against you. When we used to say at Forest, how do you like to play? We like to play attacking, exciting football, and we like to score five goals, and we like to have none scored against us. But that's not always, you can't always do that. It might be that someone's equally as good on the day and you're under pressure. But if you're under pressure, then you still want to keep a clean sheet, and then hopefully that one of your flair players will just do a bit of magic and you go in with 1-0. So it's not, it's not rocky side. So it's a bit unfair we've done it. But, I didn't really see it that way.
No, that's good to hear, actually. I think a lot of Arsenal fans have sort of been split around sort of Don, but I mean, he's had a great career, particularly obviously at Arsenal and with England. So the other thing I was just going to ask is, obviously, all the fans that I've spoken to have always thought extremely highly of you at Arsenal, and I think you always had a great relationship with them. And it must be great to go back now, and you probably get a wonderful reception when you do come back. And I suppose, have you had the chance to play in a few sort of legends kind of games over the years?
Over the years, I was saying to Marcelo earlier on, right, we used to play all the time when we finished, right, in your mid-30s, 40s and stuff like that, we'll play all over the world, right? But getting back to Arsenal, I was obviously my very good friends with Danny Fittman, who used to own the club, right? He's sadly ill with us, but he's still gone on with his wife and some other friends and stuff like that. So when he saw where we were in there, I got to know about the insides of Arsenal Football Club a little bit as well, which was very, very well run and still with the passion of being custodians of the badge and the shirt and stuff like that. And I think at the moment, though, it's changed. It's become this sports franchise where, it seems to me that there seems to be a lot of chiefs and not many Indians, and any accountability of who's doing what, which seems to be. And it's changing. It might be called progress, as Clutter used to say, but it's definitely changing. And, I can remember, it's another story for your Arsenal lads, right? When Highbury was closing, before they had the final game and everything was done and things like that, I did something for German television with Boris Becker. So Boris came on to London and we filmed in the local pub. It's the Gunners around the corner. We had a beer together and we played snooker and we chatted about Arsenal. And then I got in touch with the club beforehand to say we'd like to come do it, do some filming around here. They said, fine. Go with Paddy, an Irishman, who's in charge of all the changing rooms and stuff. So I called Paddy. Paddy, yes. So we got to Paddy. I introduced him to Boris. And Paddy goes straight away to his cupboard and gets a whiskey bottle out. So we had a glass of whiskey in the catacombs of Highbury, right? And then Paddy's going on saying, I don't allow everyone in here. He says, only the lads who I've got on well with over the years. And he said, he's one of them, pointing to me, and there's so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. All the rest you can forget, right? This is what he said. We're having a few whiskeys. And Paddy takes us round, right? And we're up in the director's box and stuff. And he's standing there and he starts singing Danny Boy, oh Danny Boy. And he's got tears coming down his face, looking out over Highbury singing. So I said, to Paddy, what's the matter? He said, oh, I've just got a bit emotional there. He says, because we're moving to the Emirates in a couple of weeks' time or a month's time, whatever it was. And he says, they've made me redundant. I said, you got to be, this is like an iconic figure down around the changing rooms for years. Yeah. I said, you've got to be soaking out here. So he said, no, they're not taking a lot of the people. The people who have been in the turnstiles for many years, right, who have gone to all the families. They've had, the father's been there, the grandfather's been there. Now they're on the turnstile. And because it's all modern and electrical or, touched turnstiles, they're all not being part of it. Instead of keeping them or doing something for a year with them or something like that. Anyway, so I get onto the club and I start having a moment up saying, what's happening? You can't be sure, iconic figure, part of the club and the history and everything, these guys down below, blah, blah. So cut a long story short, I try and get in touch with Paddy. He went on holiday, I think he was gone to Spain with his son. Anyway, he had a heart attack and died. He said he died of a broken heart, not being taken to the... So I got the film of Boris and myself and Danny him singing Danny Boy, Paddy singing Danny Boy, in the film of what was being shown on German television, and got it to his son, right? As a keepsake. It's just another story at Highbury that no one knows about, and all these human stories, and we've moving from the old stadium to a new stadium, what it entails, people have been at Highbury with old generations, and the turnstiles and stuff like that,
I have to say, I have to say, Tony, it's really amazing hearing that. And I know that Mark will be very touched by many of the stories that you said and so on, and incredible insights. And as somebody who, my main profession is a German-English translator, but I am also a journalist as well. And, it's a real privilege to be able to talk to you guys and hear these stories. And what you were saying very much kind of mirrors what Marcel Raducanu has been saying to me over the years about how, despite German clubs being a lot more loyal to the players and so on, and being more of a family set up and more of a community set up, the clubs are 50+1 rule and so on, where the clubs are owned by the members. And essentially, the clubs are looking to break even. They're not really profit motivated. They're not, most of them, apart from B4B, ironically, are not are not businesses like that in terms of shareholders and profits and so on. And it, a lot of it's about, in Germany at least, the sort of thing that that I know Mark appreciates and I've always stood for is that kind of community aspect of German football, and it being very much still kind of something which you can really relate to and be part of. I mean, I'm a shareholder of Dortmund, but I'm also a member of Dortmund, and I was a former referee with Dortmund's football department for several years, and go right back to 1983 when I was first out there with my stepfather going to matches and so on. And there is something very special, I would say, about that loyalty. But even Marcel himself, who, I mean, you'll remember Marcel Raducanu very well, incredibly gifted Borussia Dortmund player. He says that it's very hard for him to get a ticket. He doesn't, that generation of players don't get season tickets anymore at Borussia Dortmund. And, I'm not knocking my club, but essentially, the demand for tickets for Borussia Dortmund, I would have thought that there would always be space for a couple of season tickets for former players, people like yourself, Tony and Marcello. But it is very business driven, and part of the reason we do this fan club is to give English fans access to the German football and to Borussia Dortmund as a football club. I would just love to ask you, what makes Borussia Dortmund for you such a special football club? You've played there, you played there back in the 80s and so on, you kept in touch with Marcel and so on. What do you think of Borussia Dortmund as a team? Because after all, it is a Borussia Dortmund podcast, and not so much technically the team, but as a club, really, what makes them special for you? Because FC Cologne similarly have a very community and family ethos, like Dortmund. But what do you like about Borussia Dortmund as a team and as a club?
First of all, you've got 80,000 people there every week, with a great atmosphere, right? I think the area where you're in, right? I know you've got Schalke as your main rivals and stuff like that, but I'm not sure if Dortmund, but I know for Schalke, that they relate, to the people who are working in and around the town. And I think that's the same, with Dortmund as well. What I've heard about it, the people who go and watch the games, there are free buses going to the stadium, that everything revolves around BVB, so to speak, Whereas in London, we've got 13 Premier League clubs, I believe, and stuff like that, You've just got a one club there in Dortmund, and that city makes the city relate to it. But your yellow wall and all your fans and everything like that. I think it's only been the last few years that fans in England and in other countries realise what the atmosphere is like there.
That's right.
It's an absolute pleasure to play there. All I know is the players. They seem to be very happy there. They seem to have a really good way of getting young players in, and the way that they play as well is an exciting way to play. And you can't have 80,000 people there and then sort of just play tippy-tappy football, right? Which puts me off the game, So I think they play with speed and they play with a passion. And I think that relates to the fans as well. All the fans relate to that,
And let me just ask, I think we'll make your second spell very brief because of the time that we've had tonight, and we're so grateful to you for your time, but we must talk about the England part of your career just at the end. I just want to ask you, when you went back, just briefly, what is it that makes German football? I mean, I'm a huge fan of German football since I was a kid, but you're a player that's played in England and in Germany. What is it that makes German football so remarkable? Is it that community feeling? Is it the fact that the clubs are much closer to the fans, the atmospheres in the Bundesliga stadiums, and just kind of that sense of connectedness? I mean, between the city and the club, like in Cologne, you see so much red and white. I went to watch a game there last season against Frankfurt, and it was absolutely brilliant on the Südtribüne. I wore my yellow and black shirt, and you're absolutely welcome. And those amazing songs that they have at FC Cologne, FC Köller, that song they sing before, your hair's standing up on you. It's absolutely fantastic. But similarly at Dortmund, the amazing songs on the Gelbe Wand and so on. What is it that makes German football for you so special? Because you're very, very much valued in Germany, and a lot of the German friends of mine were very excited to hear. I'm talking to Tony Woodcock, somebody you know who's very well known in Germany, even to this date. And you go, I see things you've done, TV stuff and press things. You go back to Germany a lot, and you've got family, you've got your kids there, your former wife, I believe. And what is it that makes German football so special? Is it that sense of community? Is it that sense of connectedness to the fans, that kind of Bodenständigkeit?
Well, there is that, but it's no different to other cities, whether they're in England or in Spain or Italy, right? You know, when you want to go to Liverpool, you want to go to Manchester United, Arsenal maybe not, because Arsenal's in London, right? You've got lack of colour, because you know you've got 5 miles from each other, you've got Spurs and Arsenal, right? So if they're playing each other, there's no colours there, right? Because it's all North London. But if you go to Newcastle, to the cities where they're one club, you're going to get Leeds coming up now, right? That's going to be all blue and white or whatever, right? So I think it's where whether it's in Germany or England or anywhere else, where it's a team that the city relates to by itself, right? Not that there's three or four there or something. Okay, Manchester a little bit different. You've got City and United, but a lot of them have got that community spirit, whether it's Germany or the UK. But I think over the years that because now you see in the Bundesliga, the fans are really seeing the colours in the Bundesliga, the flags, the stuff that they bring down, over the fans beforehand and stuff like that, which is a slightly different, to in England, right? But you still get some of that in the stadiums in England where you go in. But I'm trying to find an answer here, which I haven't really got one.
No, it seems to be the atmosphere.
I mean, you get the atmosphere in, like I said, you go to Manchester, go to Liverpool, right? Go to Everton, you're going to get the atmospheres there, right? I can't say what the difference is, right? Where there's a football match and you've got the passion there, wherever it is in the world, you've got the similar sort of passion and that feeling when you're in the stadiums, right? It just so happens that most of the Bundesliga clubs seem to have that at the moment, yeah?
Absolutely spot on. And let's not forget the prices, which are remarkable. I mean, Dortmund, a season ticket's about £300 to £400, whereas at the Emirates, you get a very comfortable experience. But I have to say the prices are, £1,000, £2,000 and so on. I mean, it's not for the faint-hearted, let's be very frank.
Exactly. That's why they say a lot of Londoners would rather go to Dortmund than go to the Emirates or somewhere. And it's a better price to go all that way. That's what we're saying. I can remember there was something on the radio saying, we get over into Germany or whatever, we go down, once we get to Dortmund, we've got free transport, we can go and get a hot dog or something like that and a couple of beers at a third of the price what they're going to be costing us over in England. So it's a better trip for them, and they're seeing something else. We've got 80,000 people there who are putting on a show outside the football field, so to speak,
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
There's no doubt. It makes a big difference. And Ben, I'm disappointed that the London Super Horse Club. But I would say partly for that reason, to enjoy that experience and love of football. Probably sort of football more like the football I was used to when I first started watching football. I feel as though it's changed a lot, and something that touched on being in the Premier League now. I mean, it was very like. To me, as an Englishman, then going to Germany to watch the games, I don't get that feeling at all. I get this feeling of wonderful camaraderie and people because we're English.
Hello?
Oh. Hello?
Tony, the last part of the show, England. You're a huge England international. You played with great legends. Bobby Robson was the coach. One of my favourite ever players, Brian Robson, Captain Marvel, always played for the wrong team. I've never been a Man U fan, but España 82, you played against Germany. And on the other side of the pitch were obviously a lot of your FC Cologne friends, people like Toni Schumacher, Pierre Littbarski, and so on. And that jersey at España 82, if you ever kept any jerseys, I really hope you kept that Admiral shirt That really was absolutely fantastic.
Well, we're talking about England. If you go back a little bit, I think it must have been I just left, gone back to Oslo, I'm not sure. And it was England versus Germany at Wembley. And I was on the subs bench. I'd just gone back to England, you know, to try and get play for England and that. And Germany went 2-1. Rummenigge got both goals. And I went on and I make it 2-1. Right, but the corner before it's all in the box. We both got out for a corner, and Tony and I'm near Tony, and he puts his massive gloves around my face and said, "You've got no chance here tonight." Right? He said, "You put one in the net. It's 100 whatever it was euros or Deutschmark." And from that corner, right, I smashed one in the top corner and get a goal back for England. Right? I don't think he's ever paid me. Right? For that. but that day there was a lot of Cologne players there. It might have been Alofs, Dybalski was there, I think. Stefan Engels was there. Strack was there. And if you're in the tunnel at Wembley, if you go in the tunnel, England are on the left-hand side, the Germans on the right. So I popped my head in to say hello, and they dragged me in there, yeah, which was nice. You know, all the Cologne lads dragged me in and said, "You should be in this changing room, right? Not the other one, yeah?" So they in the German changing room for a couple of minutes, yeah?
Fantastic. Fantastic. Is España 82, is that a particularly important campaign? It was for me. I was an 11-year-old little lad watching. We used to go to a restaurant, which was the only place there was a TV, while we were living in Mallorca at the time. And, you know, for me, I'm a huge England fan. And I remember as I said, Brian Robson, Kevin Keegan and so on. And what a World Cup that was. Players like Zico, Falcao, Socrates, as you say, Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, Hansi Müller, Paolo Rossi was unbelievable. Dino Zoff. I mean, for me, that was one of the most extraordinary World Cups. I mean, maybe it was because it was the year my brother was born. I don't know. But I just remember it being quite remarkable. And although the England team didn't actually go on to do that particularly well, you played with a hell of a lot of style. And who could forget that team? And that was the show with England, FC Cologne and Arsenal and Nottingham Forest legend Tony Woodcock, one of the great England players and certainly a very memorable show for Mark and myself. In terms of social media, Tony is old school and he said that he doesn't have social media. And he asked anyone who wants to get in touch with him for autographs and similar to write to the London Fan Club, and we will pass it on. Mark can be reached at the at mark@sportslineuk.com, and the Borussia Dortmund London Fan Club, as usual, can be reached via Facebook at Borussia Dortmund Fan Club England on Facebook. And during the season, you can come and meet us and watch a match and have a beer at the Naughty Bar in Cleveland Street, just off Oxford Street in central London. And that was episode 12. Thank you so much for your interest, and I hope you enjoyed the show. And please remember to share and like the show if you enjoyed it. Good night.